belly was full. He nodded slowly. Tim, butcher the cattle. Let the meat freeze and hide it in the loft under the hay until you need it. He glanced out the window toward the Betts house. I better go. Colonel Parsons may be waiting for me.
Don't go yet, Sam, Mother said. We've just seen you.
I'll be around all winter, Mother. Maybe I can get it attached to Colonel Parsons' staff. I'll try to get a pass if I can. Anyway, I can always slip out at night. It's risky. Colonel Parsons is not harsh, but General Putnam is in charge. He's a great patriot, but he's rough and tough on men who shirk their duty. 100 lashes for desertion, and if there's too much of it, I know he'll hang some people as an example. That's the kind of man he is. But I'll be back to visit again, one way or another. He left. We walked out into the yard with him, and he crossed over to the Betts house and went in.
He's so thin, Mother said. I worry that he'll get sick. I couldn't bear to lose another, Tim.
All at once she began to sob. It only lasted 10 seconds. Then she turned and went into the house. And when I went in a minute later, she was calmly scrubbing some beets. After December 3rd, we began to get used to the sight of soldiers constantly around town. There were always messengers going by and trains of supply wagons crunching over the snow, and sometimes groups of soldiers on work parties would appear at the tavern for beer. Having the troops around was good for business. Some of the officers lodged in houses around about. Often in the evening they came up to the tavern to play cards and drink or smoke. Business was good, or rather, it would have been good if we had anything to sell, and people had had anything to pay for it with besides commissary scrip. The biggest demand was for liquor. Life at the encampment was cold and miserable, and the only relief for them was drinking. They didn't care what it was, rum, whiskey, cider, anything we could get. Whiskey was pretty hard to get. The General Assembly had made it illegal to distill whiskey because it was made from grain, and grain was needed for food. Rum was easier to get, and we could usually get cider because every farmer made it. I spent a lot of time riding around among the farmers buying whatever they had. They'd often have rum they'd taken in trade for livestock. I could offer them good prices for liquor because we could get good prices for it. The officers didn't care how much they paid for liquor. As they said when they were drinking, a short life but a merry one. Which of them knew when he was going to die? Of course, the ordinary soldiers didn't have much fun. For one thing, there was always the snow. It came down in a great blizzard about a week after the troops had started to build the encampment. Their huts were not finished, and they were forced to work in bitter cold and storm. The cold was a problem. The huts were really just tiny log cabins with big stone fireplaces making the whole rear wall. In cold weather, they had a lot of trouble getting the mortar to set. Because of this, the chimneys leaked so badly that half the smoke blew back into the room. The snow made hewing wood difficult, too. Sam told us that they were having an awful time getting the huts finished. Even when they were done, they weren't much to live in. 12 soldiers jammed into a 14-by-16 room, breathing more smoke than air, and having to stumble over people whenever they wanted to move around. And the snow never stopped falling. By January, it covered the countryside 3 feet deep, so that the stone walls disappeared. You could drive a sled over the snow anywhere you wanted without paying attention to where the roads were. Sam was able to get into town every week or 10 days. Colonel Parsons used him as a messenger a lot because he knew his way around Reading. Sometimes he would come in with a commissary officer looking for lime or nails or leather or all the hundreds of things armies needed. The idea was that Sam might know who had things. Often he'd come into the tavern and ask me if I knew who had hay or sleds or something else to sell. To be honest, I felt uneasy about telling him such things. The commissary people always paid for whatever they bought, but it was usually in scrip, and on top of it, the farmer didn't have much choice about selling or not. But I couldn't bring myself to lie to Sam. It was something I'd never done. All the time, Sam was after us to butcher the cattle. I didn't know what to do. The idea of selling them to the British was gone. With all the rebel troops around, it was too risky trying to move cattle anywhere. Besides, it would have been next to impossible in that deep snow. Still, I kept hoping that I could find someone who'd offer me a good deal for them. But Sam was pressing me. I'm warning you, Tim. Sooner or later, somebody's going to get them.
I thought General Putnam gave strict orders against stealing.
Oh, he did. And knowing General Putnam, he'll hang any soldier he catches stealing. He's tough as nails, but he's honest. Besides, he wants the people to come around to our side, and if he lets the troops forage, he'll lose all sympathy with the populace. Oh, I know him. He's had a lot of men flogged already for disobeying orders, and I'm sure he's just itching to catch somebody stealing so he can make an example of him.
Then what's the worry?
Don't be stupid, Tim. A lot of men will take a chance anyways, especially when they're drunk. You wait. Sooner or later they'll get into your beef if you don't watch it.
Mother and I kept churning it around between us. She figured Sam was right. You know what happened to Sally Miles' heifer?
Mrs. Miles was a widow who lived alone in a tiny hovel in Reading. She had a few tough chickens and one scrawny cow. She kept going mostly by selling milk and eggs to the people around. A few days earlier, a half dozen drunken soldiers had noticed her cow in her barn, butchered it right there, and carried the slabs of beef back to the encampment in the dark.
I know, I said, but the thing we need most is rum, and the only way to pay for it is with cattle.
That was the beginning of January. We decided to stick it out through the month. There was a rumor going around that the British were forming up in New York City and were going to raid towns on Long Island. What that meant, nobody knew, but some believed that the men from the encampment would be called down there to fight. I just couldn't make up my mind. The weeks went by. There was nothing anybody wanted but to get through this terrible winter. It didn't seem that the war could really go on much longer. Even Sam thought it would have to end soon. We talked about it one evening when he was there for a short visit. We were sitting in front of the taproom fire one night in late January. I think something decisive will happen in the spring, he said. The English government realizes by now that they're not going to beat us easily. Maybe they figured you're too starved and tired to fight much longer. He shook his head seriously. They might be right, he said. The other day, some of the men were actually talking mutiny. A lot of them have no blankets. They're short of food, and the pay hasn't come through. A bunch of them decided to march to Hartford and demand their pay. They were about to start out when General Putnam rode up and talked them out of it. Then he had a couple of the ringleaders shot right there. He shows no mercy when he thinks he's right. Suddenly he stopped talking.
What was that?
I'd heard it too. A kind of a thump and then a cow bawling. We listened. There were noises coming from outside somewhere.
Sound like something's bothering the cattle, I said.
There are people out there, Sam shouted. Let's go! We ran out through the kitchen toward the barn. It was dark, but there was nearly a full moon reflected on the snow, and plenty enough light to see what had happened. The barn doors were open. Two cows were standing in front of the barn, blinking, and we could see two more behind. We dashed into the barn. Four of the cows were gone.
Jesus damn, I shouted.
Pen 'em up, Sam shouted. They'll be butchering the others somewhere near. There's no chance of driving them very far in this snow. He darted around the house toward the road, his eyes following the hoofprints in the snow. I snatched up a shovel and drove the remaining four cattle back into the barn with the handle. They were balky, and it took me a few minutes to get them inside and the door shut and latched. Then I raced across the snow around the house to the road. There, I stopped and swung my eyes across the horizon. I saw nothing, but distantly, I heard the noise of shouting, off toward the far end of the training ground. I ran in the direction of the sounds, and then suddenly I saw three men walking toward me through the moonlight, side by side. I stopped and waited. They came up. The one in the middle was Sam. His nose was bleeding, and there was a cut in his chin. His hands were tied behind his back. I stood in the open white snowy field, surrounded by shadowy trees.
Sam! I shouted.
Timmy, get Colonel Parsons, he cried. They're taking me in as a cattle thief. I went cold. Then I turned and ran. Chapter 13. I want to see Colonel Parsons, please, sir, I said. The adjutant stared at me through the half-open door.
What about?
Sam Meeker sent me. He's been arrested as a cattle thief.
Colonel Parsons can't be troubled about that.
But it's all a mistake, I said. He didn't do it. He was chasing the ones who did.
The adjutant laughed. Sure, he said. He didn't steal the cows. They've followed him out of the barn of their own accord.
Please, I begged.
It's true. We were sitting there. Enough, he said. Colonel Parsons is in bed. Come back in the morning and perhaps he'll see you then. There wasn't any point in arguing with him, I realized. I would have to see Colonel Parsons in the morning. The cows were still loose, and I had to do something about them anyway. Thank you, sir, I said, and turned and ran back over the empty spaces of snow toward the training ground. In the brightness of the moonlight, it was easy to see the forms of three cattle standing in the middle of the snowy field. As fast as I could, I pushed out into the snow toward them. As I came up, I saw the fourth cow lying on the ground. It was dead, half buried in the snow, and its belly had been sliced open, its guts glistening wet in the moonlight. The three living cows were staggering around in the deep snow and bawling unhappily. I found a stick in the tree line at the edge of the field and began driving the cattle home. It was a terrible job. They hated floundering around in the deep snow and balked constantly. It took me over half an hour to get them safely back into the barn. I threw them down some hay, and then I went into the tavern. Mother was sitting in front of the fire, looking worried.
I saw you coming across the road, she said. Where's Sam?
They arrested him, I said. The ones who stole the cattle beat him up, and then they said he'd stolen the cattle himself and marched him off somewhere.
Back to the encampment?
I guess so, I said. They'll let him go in the morning, won't they? I mean, all we have to do is explain it, don't we?
She shook her head. I have a terrible foreboding, Timothy. I want to pray.
The dead cow is still out there, Mother. I want to get it before somebody else does.
If we haven't got time to pray to the Lord for help, we haven't got much time at all, have we?
So we got down on our knees and prayed for Sam. Then I got the butchering knives out, and we went together into the snowfield and cut up the cow. The meat was already beginning to freeze, making it hard to cut. We had to chop it into small pieces, too, because neither of us was strong enough to carry off a whole side of beef by ourselves. It took us an hour of struggling to cut the animal up and carry it home. We hid it in the barn loft under the hay. It would keep well enough in that cold weather. In the morning, I went back to Captain Betts' house to talk to Colonel Parsons. They made me wait around outside the door for half an hour before they let me in. Colonel Parsons seemed nice enough, but awfully busy. I told him the story, but he shrugged. It surprises me that Sam would be taken for a thief. I thought he was a man of greater patriotism than that, but people fool you.
He didn't do it, sir. These other men...
He held up his hand to stop me.
I know. You told me that. In any case, there isn't anything I can do. They've taken him out to the encampment, and it'll be up to General Putnam to do what he wants. I'd get out there in a hurry, though. The general is determined to make an example of somebody. It could go hard with Sam. General Putnam is a great and dedicated patriot, and he does not take defection from duty lightly.
Now I was beginning to get worried. At first it had seemed that it wouldn't take much to straighten the mistake out. After all, it was our cows that had been stolen. Surely they'd believe us when we told them Sam hadn't taken them. But the way Colonel Parsons talked about it bothered me. He didn't seem to care very much whether Sam was guilty or not. It didn't seem very important to him. I said so to Mother. She looked sad.
They've seen so much death, these soldiers. What does the life of one more man mean to them?
She sighed.
Now we must go down to the encampment and try to save him.
We couldn't both go. One of us had to stay and watch the tavern. We were required by law to keep open most of the time in case travelers came by. In any case, it was risky to leave the place unguarded. We decided that Mother ought to go. She was an adult. Her word would go better with General Putnam than mine would. She put on her bonnet and wrapped a shawl around her shoulders and started out. I stood in the yard and watched her go down the road until she was merely a black spot in the field of white. Then I went out to the barn to look the cattle over more carefully, in case any of them had been hurt. Not that it mattered much. I was determined to butcher them as soon as I had a chance. Betsy Reed came into the tavern a half hour later. She hadn't bothered to comb her hair properly, and she looked scared.
"What's happened to Sam? I heard he was arrested for something."
"For stealing our own cattle," I said. She got angry.
"Sam didn't do that," she said.
"I didn't say he did." I told her the story. Mother's really worried. I've never seen her so down, not even when we found out Father was dead.
She bore up when he got captured, and bore up when we learned he'd died. But she isn't bearing up now. She's trying, but she isn't bearing up.
It's not having enough to eat, Betsy said.
You don't have the strength to keep your spirits up.
She sat and dropped her head on the taproom table.
What are we going to do about Sam?
I don't know. Mother's finding out.
Will they hang him if they think he did it?
I don't know, I said. It seemed a good chance that they would, the way everybody was talking about how hard General Putnam was. But I didn't want to think about that.
Probably they would just put him in prison.
I wouldn't mind that, Betsy said. At least he wouldn't be able to get himself into any more trouble. I didn't say anything. All I could think about was Father and Jerry Sanford.
Could your father do anything?
Maybe, she said. I'll talk to him right away. She left. I was glad. I didn't want to dwell on Sam. There were plenty of things to do to keep myself busy. Besides my regular chores, I had to start getting ready to butcher. This meant putting up hooks for hanging the meat in the barn. We'd never butchered 8 head of cattle at one time, and we didn't have the hanging space for them. To occupy my mind, I spent my spare moments figuring out the best way to do it. And of course, people kept coming in. There were the usual customers, officers wanting food, ordinary soldiers wanting a chance to get warm, Redding people buying things. There were also people asking about Sam. Word had got around, and people wanted to know what had happened. Mr. Beach came in, and Mr. Heron and Captain Betts. I expected that Mother would be back by noon, but she wasn't. And by mid-afternoon, I began to worry. I kept looking out of the window every 5 minutes, but still she didn't come. I got the supper stew started. It was about all we served to anybody anymore. It began to get dark, and then she came in. She looked exhausted. She slumped down in a chair by the fire. I gave her a glass of rum to warm her up, and was about to ask her what had happened, but just then some officers came in wanting dinner and some drinks, and we got busy. It wasn't until an hour later when we'd got the officers settled over their rum and water that she could tell me the story out in the kitchen. She'd had to wait until the middle of the afternoon to see General Putnam. The aides kept putting her off and sending her away, but she stuck it out and finally she got to see him. He was curt. He really didn't want to take the time. She told the story. He merely shrugged. You see what the problem is, Tim? Those 2 men who brought him in have sworn it was Sam who stole the animals. Her voice was slow and tired and hopeless. Sam wasn't supposed to be here. He was supposed to be on duty with Colonel Parsons at the Betts house. But Colonel Parsons didn't care. He always let Sam come over and visit. Still, he wasn't supposed to. Officially, Sam had deserted his post. Why should they believe Sam about the cattle over the other men? Why should they believe me? I'm his mother. I'd certainly lie to save him. She paused. Go out and see if the officers need anything, and bring me some more rum. I'm cold. They wouldn't let us see Sam, but a few days later, Colonel Reed came into the tavern and sat down with Mother and me. He looked serious. I've been down to the encampment, he said. I've talked with some of the officers there. I'm afraid it looks bad for Sam. Would you like some rum, Colonel Reed? Mother asked. Her voice was harsh. I'm going to have some myself. Without waiting for him to answer, she brought the rum and poured 2 glasses. Thank you, Colonel Reed said.
Why is it bad for Sam, sir? I asked.
He sipped at the rum.
Here's the problem. Those soldiers Sam caught with the cattle are scared to death. Putnam will simply decide to hang them all as an example. They're prepared to tell any kind of lie about Sam to get themselves off. If it were just Sam's word against somebody else's, it might be different. But there are 2 of them, and if they tell the same story, they can be convincing.
He shook his head.
Then there's the fact that Sam comes from a Tory family.
We're not really Tories, though, I said. Father wasn't, none of us are.
That's not the way General Putnam's going to see it.
But won't there be a trial, sir? I said.
Oh, yes, Colonel Reed said. A regular court-martial. There'll be a presiding justice and a board of officers acting as the jury. But we have to face the fact that the board will do whatever they think General Putnam wants. And if they decide that Putnam wants to make an example of somebody, they'll hang.
They'll bend over backwards to satisfy him, regardless of the evidence.
What can we do?
Pray, Colonel Reed said. Actually, there are some others going to be tried at the same time. A butcher named Edward Jones from Ridgefield who was caught spying for the British, another man for stealing shoes, and another for desertion, I think. So there's always hope that they'll get enough blood out of the others to let Sam go. His war record is good, and that'll help.
The trial was set for February 6th, 3 weeks away. There was nothing to do but wait it out. I didn't know what to think. I didn't see how they could find Sam guilty. He'd fought for 3 years. He'd risked his life. How could they decide to punish him for something he hadn't done? It just didn't make any sense. Two or three times I went out to the encampment to try to see him, but they wouldn't let me. They had him locked up in a cabin they were using for a prison, but they wouldn't even tell me which one it was, because they were afraid I'd smuggle a weapon to him or help him escape or something. After I'd been out there a couple of times, they realized who I was, so they wouldn't even let me into the encampment. I figured I could sneak in after dark if I had to. They'd cut down most of the trees around about for lumber and firewood, but there were rocks on the sides of the steep hills which let down into the encampment, and I figured I could come down in their shadows. But there wasn't any use in trying until I knew where they'd hidden him, so I gave up for the moment and waited. I was beginning to get worried about Mother. She'd never been one for drinking much, just a glass of rum punch occasionally when she was chilled or sick. But she'd begun to take it more. Not that she was drunk all the time or anything like that, but sometimes I'd come upon her standing by herself with her eyes empty and staring, and a little glass of rum in her hands. She'd hardly notice I was there until I spoke to her. It wasn't much, as I say, but she was changed, and it bothered me. Finally, February 6th came. Colonel Reed came in first thing in the morning. "I'm going out to the encampment," he said. "I'll bring back news tonight." All day long I was so nervous I couldn't eat. I couldn't sit still. I had to keep moving around, and I was glad when people came in wanting food or hot drinks so I could keep busy. Once, two officers came in and ordered hot rum to warm up with. One of them said, "Did you see any of the court-martial?" "No," the other said. "Why bother? Putnam's determined to hang 'em all anyway." I shuddered, but I said nothing. It was after dark when Colonel Reed came in. He was tired. His shoulders were sagging, and his face was grim. He didn't have to say anything at all. I knew what had happened. "Where's your mother?" "She's out back in the kitchen."
I went and got her. She stood in the doorway, saying nothing. "Mrs. Meeker, I have bad news. They're going to execute Sam."
She smiled politely.
"That isn't news, Colonel Reed. I've known that for 3 weeks."
That was the story.
The man who had been caught stealing shoes would get 100 lashes. The deserter would get 100 lashes. The butcher, Edward Jones, was to be hung. Sam Meeker, cattle thief, was to be shot. The executions would take place on a hill near the encampment on February 16th, a Tuesday. The Sunday before, there would be a compulsory church attendance. It surprised me that I didn't cry or faint or anything like that. I was numb and nervous, and nothing more. And I began making plans. The first thing I did was to go see Colonel Parsons. He put me off twice because he knew what I was coming for, but as he was quartered next door to us, he knew he'd have to see me sooner or later, and finally he did.
"I can't help you," he said bluntly. "The court-martial has decided, and that's the end of it."
"Then who can help me, sir?" I demanded. He stared at me.
"General Putnam. Nobody but General Putnam."
"All right, then. Give me a note to him, sir."
"Why should I do that?" he asked.
"Because Sam didn't do it. You know that's true." He stared at me.
"Sir."
"Sir." He put his head down in his hands.
"War is hard, boy. Sometimes we do a lot of things we don't want to do. A lot of very good men have been killed in this war, and all we can do is hope that it's been worth it. Maybe it hasn't. Maybe in the end we'll conclude that, but I don't think so. I think it will be worth it, despite the death and destruction."
He raised his head again and looked at me. No, he said. I don't think that Sam stole those cows. But I can't prove it, and neither can you. Who knows? Maybe he did do it after all. Maybe he had some kind of arrangement with those other men so as to throw suspicion off himself. Sam would never have done that. He smacked his hand down on the desk. Watch how you address me, he snapped. I blushed. I'm sorry, sir. He put his hands behind his head and leaned back. Do you want to know what General Putnam is thinking? It's this. He's thinking that he can't win the war if he doesn't keep the people on his side. He's thinking that he can't keep the people on his side if the troops are running amok among the civilian population, raping the women, stealing cattle, burning houses. He is determined to scare the wits out of the troops to keep them in line. And he's thinking that it doesn't matter very much who he executes to do it. So many men have died. So many mothers have wept. So many brothers and sisters have cried. He is thinking that, in the long run, if he executes somebody, he'll shorten the war and save more lives. Doesn't matter to him very much who he executes. One man's agony is like another's. One mother's tears are no wetter than anybody else's. And that's why he's going to have Sam shot. But Sam isn't guilty, sir. The court-martial says he was. But they're wrong. He sat silent. I waited. Then he said, because I happen to believe you, I'm going to give you a letter to see General Putnam. But I am warning you right now that it won't do a bit of good. The one thing Putnam cannot do at this point is show clemency. If he is going to make his point with the troops, he can't start letting people off easily. He took up a piece of paper, wrote something on it swiftly, folded it and sealed it, and addressed it to General Putnam. Then he gave it to me, and I left, running. I ran most of the way out to the encampment over the packed snow. The sky was cloudy. There would be snow, and more snow. I arrived at the gate, my breath rasping in my throat so hard I couldn't speak. I handed my letter to the guard. He took it, and he called over a soldier. Take this boy to General Putnam, he said. We walked up the encampment street past a long line of huts. They were identical, 100 of them, with plumes of bluish smoke rising like a forest into the air. Soldiers were everywhere, cutting wood, cleaning things, drilling. Then we came to a house, bigger than the huts, but made of the same kind of logs. The soldier handed my letter to the guard at the door. The guard took it inside, and in about 5 minutes he came back. Just wait, he said. I waited for half an hour, and then an hour, and then 2 hours. Officers went in and out, and still I waited. I got hungry, but I didn't dare leave to go in search of something to eat. It became 1 in the afternoon, and then a soldier came out and brought me in. General Putnam was sitting behind a rough trestle table they'd set up for his desk. There were papers neatly arranged and ink bottles, pens, sand for blotting the ink, and a stack of maps. He was a big man of about 60 with lots of white hair. He wore the Continental uniform of buff and blue. He did not look kind. Meeker! Yes, sir. All right, let's have it. He scared me. His voice was hard, and his eyes flashed. But I told him the story exactly as it had happened, and I finished by saying, Sam wouldn't steal our own cattle. He just wouldn't. He's been fighting for 3 years. He's been a good soldier. And he didn't do it, sir. I swear it. I know because...
Enough, he said. My time's valuable.
He took up a piece of paper and quickly wrote something on it. Then he said,
I'll consider it. That'll be all.
Sir, can I see my brother? He frowned at me. Then he shouted,
Sergeant, take this boy up to the stockade to see Sam Meeker. See that they stay 6 feet apart and pass nothing between them.
Thank you, sir, I said, and then I followed the guard out. The stockade was situated just at the bottom of the slope which dropped down into the encampment. It was a wooden hut like the others, but surrounded on all sides by a picket fence to give the prisoners a place outdoors to walk around in. Guards were posted at every corner. There were some small holes cut in the fence, each about a foot square.
the guard put his face to one of the holes and shouted, "Meeker, you've got a visitor here." Then he drew a line in the snow with his toe about 6 feet from the fence. "Stay behind that line," he said. Sam's face appeared at the hole. He was dirty and unshaven, and his hair was uncombed. "Timmy," he said. "How are you, Sam?" I said. "Oh, I'm all right for a man about to die." "Don't give up hope," I said. "I've just seen General Putnam. He said he'd consider your case."
"Is that right?" he said.
"Really? He said he would."
"What did he actually say?" Sam said.
"Does he believe I'm not guilty?"
"I don't know," I said. "He didn't say." "You're a good boy, Tim."
"Sam, how come they found you guilty?"
"I guess I didn't score enough telling points," he said.
"No, really."
"The other men lied. They knew they were in for it right from the moment I spotted them in the training ground. I only saw one of them at first, and I leveled the musket at him. But the other one was down on the ground in the shadows gutting the cow, and he came up behind me and stuck his knife point against my back. So they got me. Then they bashed me around a little and took me in. They were smart. They had a story all worked out about hearing somebody shout, 'Stop, thief!' and seeing me driving the cattle across the training ground and coming out to get me. And of course, I wasn't supposed to be at home anyway. I was supposed to be on duty at the Betts house. So that went against me, and that was that."
"What else can we do, Sam?"
"Pray, I guess. You'd better have Mother do that. The Lord is more likely to believe her than you, Tim."
He grinned. I grinned back, but I felt all sick inside. Then the guard said,
"Time's up, lad."
"I'll try to get back to see you again, Sam," I said.
"Say hello to Betsy for me," he said.
"Yes."
"And Mother," he said.
"Yes," I said. "And I'll try to think up some more telling points for General Putnam, too." He grinned.
"You're the best brother I've got, Tim."
I tried to grin back.
"I better be." "Come on, you," the guard said.
So I waved goodbye and left. Chapter 14. There was nothing to do now but wait to see what General Putnam decided. So we waited. Betsy Reed came down to the tavern a lot. We talked over a lot of plans, escape plans and all that kind of thing, but none of them seemed very good. A week passed. And on Saturday, February 13th, Colonel Reed came up from the encampment with the word that General Putnam had refused our plea for clemency. I began to cry. "It's just so unfair. He fought for them for 3 years, and now they're going to shoot him for nothing." Colonel Reed shook his head sadly.
"I know, Tim," he said. "I know. War is never fair. Who chooses which men get killed and which ones don't?"
He touched my shoulder.
"You have to accept it now. Be brave, and help your mother to bear up. She needs somebody now."
But I didn't feel brave, nor like bearing up. All I felt was angry and bitter and ready to kill somebody. If I only knew who. Sunday's church service seemed specially important so everybody could pray for the souls of the men who were going to die on Tuesday. Mother refused to go. Instead, she sat calmly by the fire, sewing. "We're required to go, Mother."
"I'm not going," she said. "They can murder who they like, church who they like, but I'm not going. For me, the war is over." I went.
But after a half an hour of sitting in the balcony where I'd sat beside Sam so many hundreds of times, I began to cry and I walked out. Nobody tried to stop me. I guess they knew how I felt. We closed the tavern early that night. Nobody was there anyways. I guess nobody wanted to be around us. It was too gloomy.
"I would like to close the place forever," Mother said. I noticed that she had stopped drinking rum, for it was already over, and there wasn't anything left to be nervous about.
"It was Father's tavern," I said.
"I won't serve any more Continental officers," she said. "Never again. Never."
I knew I wouldn't be able to sleep that night, and I didn't think Mother would either. So I threw some extra logs on the fire and pulled chairs up in front of it.
"We've got to think of something, Mother."
"There's nothing," she said.
Let the dead bury the dead.
He isn't dead yet, Mother. He's still alive.
He's dead, Tim, she said. He's dead as your father is.
No, I said.
I got up and took Father's bayonet down from the wall over the mantelpiece. Then I went out into the kitchen, took the steel out of the rack, and began to wet the bayonet. Mother didn't get up. She didn't say anything. I worked over the bayonet a good long time, until I had an edge on it that would slice through a man like a hot nail going through butter. Then I went out to the taproom and put on my coat. Mother didn't lift her eyes from the flames snapping over the logs.
Going to get yourself killed, son?
I'm going to save my brother, I said.
No, you're not, she said in a soft, whispery kind of a voice. No, you're going to get yourself killed.
Well, you might as well. Let's have it all done with at once. How does the old line go? Men must fight and women must weep.
But you'll get no more tears from me. I've done my weeping for this war.
I stared at her. Then I turned and went out the door, buttoning up my coat. There was plenty of moonlight shining on those fields of snow. It was almost as bright as daylight. I didn't dare walk along the road. You never know who would be coming along. This meant that I had to work my way through woodlots and along hedgerows across the pastures, where the snow had not been packed as hard as it was on the road. Fortunately, it had begun to pack of its own weight, so that my feet sunk in only a few inches with each step. But it was funny. Nothing seemed to bother me. I didn't feel tired or cold or worried. My head was sort of out of focus. I didn't have any plan. I knew I ought to think of one, but I couldn't really get my mind working. All I could do was just keep going on until I came to the encampment, and then see what I did next. Finally, I came to the line of trees that ran along the ridge at the top of the encampment. I dropped into a crouch and slipped from tree to tree. There weren't many of them left. The soldiers had cut most of the wood for lumber and firewood. Then I came to the last tree, just over the edge of the ridge. I stopped and stared down. The ridge sloped down sharply for about 100 yards. The line of huts ran along the bottom with the muddy road alongside of them, and here and there a cannon or a wagon standing. There were corrals for horses and livestock, but hardly any people. Light came out of the chinks and cracks in the buildings, making slashes and dots on the snow. The stockade was dead in front of me. I stared at it. The little hut, just like the others, was surrounded by that 10-foot-high fence. There was a guard standing at the corner of the stockade, but he didn't seem to be too alert. I figured he'd be cold and thinking about getting warm, and not keeping too close a watch around. I still hadn't made any plan, but there didn't seem to be many choices. About the only thing I could do was slip down there, kill the guard, open the gate, and let the prisoners out. And if he spotted me first, I could try to fling the bayonet over the fence and hope that Sam could get himself out in the confusion. It wasn't much of a plan, but it was the only one I could think of. The trees had been cut off the hillside between me and the stockade, but there was plenty of stumps and boulders scattered all over it, and I figured if I was careful, I could slip down from one to the next until I reached the bottom. Down there was an empty space of 50 feet or so between the last stump and the stockade. I'd just have to make a dash for it. I figured that the snow was bound to be packed down pretty hard, not bad for running. I began to slip down the steep hillside from stump to boulder. I went mostly on hands and knees, getting pretty soaked in the snow. I kept an eye out on the guard. He didn't seem to be looking around much. I was nearly at the bottom of the slope now, but I was still high enough on the hillside to see over the walls of the stockade. I stopped and stared. I couldn't see anybody moving around. The prisoners were all inside the hut, staying warm, I figured, although I didn't think they would be doing much sleeping. I wonder whether you cared about being warm if you knew you were going to die soon. I decided that you probably did. I glanced at the guard. He still wasn't moving much, so I slipped the rest of the way down the hill behind some boulders until I was at the edge of the open space of snow. The stockade was now only 50 feet away. I stared at the guard. He didn't move for several moments. He was leaning on his musket with his head bent forward. And I suddenly realized that he was asleep. I took the bayonet out of my belt and clutched it tight in my hand. If Sam could kill people, so could I. I decided I would go for his throat, if I could, so he wouldn't make any noise. I raised up a little. My heart was pounding, my breath was shallow, and my hand was shaking. Then I stood up and charged out from behind the boulder across the empty space of clear moonlight, my feet going crunch, crunch in the snow. The guard stirred. I drove my feet faster. He jerked his head up and stared at me, sort of dazed. I slammed forward. "Halt!" he shouted. He swept the musket up, the bayonet pointing straight at me, 20 feet away. I jerked to a stop. "Sam!" I shouted. "And Sam!" again, as loud as I could. The guard lunged toward me. I lifted the bayonet and threw it into the air. It flashed in the moonlight, spinning lazily over and over, and fell into the stockade. Then I turned and began racing as fast as I could across the snow for the safety of the boulders on the hillside. I had gone only 3 paces when the musket went off with a terrific roar. I felt something tug at my shoulder, no more than a tug, and I dashed onto the slope and then began staggering upward, zigzagging from boulder to boulder to keep protection at my back. Behind me, there was shouting and running and the sound of a horse being wheeled around. Another musket went off, and then another. I heard a ball smack into a stump somewhere near me. Now I was getting near the top. I struggled on, my breath rasping in my throat, and then I reached the trees at the top of the ridge and flung myself flat. They'd never get me now. They couldn't gallop horses in the snowfields, and I was too far ahead for them to catch me on foot. I rolled over and looked down. 2 or 3 soldiers were starting to struggle up the slope. There were men running everywhere and horses being saddled and officers shouting. I stared into the stockade. There was no action there, no people moving at all. Lying in the center of that square of snow, something shiny glistened in the moonlight. And I knew it had all been a waste. The prisoners weren't in the stockade anymore. They'd been moved to someplace else. I clutched my shoulder where it was bleeding a little and started for home, running all the way. Mother was asleep in her chair in front of the fire. Quietly, I took off my shirt and looked at the wound. The ball had skipped right across the top of my left shoulder. A little chunk of flesh was gone. My arm felt numb, but nothing seemed to be broken. I washed the wound and dressed it, and then I hid the shirt with the bullet hole in it inside my mattress. I figured they might be able to guess who'd thrown the bayonet into the stockade, but nobody would be able to prove anything. I went to bed and fell asleep immediately. Mother refused to go to the execution. I went. I knew that Sam would want somebody there, and besides, somebody would have to claim the body. They had built a gallows up on a hill to the west of the encampment. A crowd had gathered around it. I waited down the road until a troop of soldiers came by. First came the drummers, playing a slow roll, and then the troops, and then Sam and Edward Jones riding in a cart. Their hands were tied behind their backs, and around their necks there were ropes that were tied to the cart, too. Behind them were more soldiers. General Putnam was going to make sure the troops saw the execution as an example. "Sam!" I shouted as he went by. He looked around at me. His face was dead white, but he managed to give me a grin. Not much of a one, but a grin. Then they passed on by. I waited until the last of the troops had gone through. Then I ran up to where the crowd was standing and began to push my way through. When people saw who it was, they let me pass. I pushed my way up near the front of the crowd, but not all the way. I had a funny feeling that I wanted to be hidden. I didn't want to stand out where people could see me. They had already gotten Edward Jones upon the platform of the gallows. They had put a sack over his head. The rope dangled from the gallows, an arm above. A soldier slipped the noose over his head. My eyes were misty, and I couldn't see very well. Nathaniel Bartlett, the Presbyterian minister, stepped up onto the scaffold and said a prayer. Then he stepped away. I looked down at the ground. There was a funny thump, and the crowd gasped. I looked up. Jones was hanging down below the scaffold at the end of the rope. His feet almost touched the ground, and they were sort of dancing around. I hadn't seen Sam, but now they brought him out from somewhere in a bunch of soldiers. They sort of shoved him into the empty space in front of the gallows. He had a sack over his head, too. I wondered, what was it like to be inside of that? Was it hot, and did it itch? Mr. Bartlett came out and said another prayer over Sam. I tried to pray myself, but my mouth was dry and I couldn't get the words out. They turned Sam sideways to the crowd. Three soldiers stepped in front of him and raised their muskets. They were so close the gun muzzles were almost touching Sam's clothes. I heard myself scream, "Don't shoot! Don't shoot him!" And at that moment, Sam slammed backwards as if he'd been knocked over by a mallet. I never heard the guns roar. He hit the ground on his belly and flopped over on his back. He wasn't dead yet. He lay there, shaking and thrashing about, his knees jerking up and down. They had shot him from so close that his clothes were on fire. He went on jerking with flames on his chest until another soldier shot him again. Then he stopped jerking.
Epilogue. I have written this story down in the year 1826, on the 50th anniversary of the founding of our nation, to commemorate the short life of my brother Samuel Meeker, who died 47 years ago in the service of his country. I am 64. Although I hope to go on living in health for some time yet, the major portion of my own life is spent. It has been a happy life, and successful for the most part. I no longer live in Reading. After Sam's death, I hated the place and wanted to go away, but the war went on for almost 3 more years, and while the fighting was on, it was difficult to think of building a new life in another place. For the first few months after Sam's death, I was not able to do much more than my basic chores. But time heals wounds, and by the next fall I had become used to the ache in my heart, and I began to think about what I should do with my life. I started to make a study of calculating and surveying with Mr. Heron, who was kind and didn't charge me for lessons. When the war finally ended, Mother and I sold the tavern and moved out to Pennsylvania, where new lands were opening up and surveyors were much in demand. After moving around a bit, we finally settled in the town of Wilkes-Barre. We built a tavern there, and I began buying and selling land. With the profits from this activity, I built a sawmill, and then a store to go along with the tavern. And then I joined with some other men to found a bank. I married and had children, and with work and God's will, I prospered, so that I am able today to enjoy my children, my grandchildren, my orchards, and my gardens in peace and comfort. Mother never really got over Sam's death. She kept to her vow, and so long as the war went on, she refused to serve Continental officers. I had to do it myself. She lived to a ripe old age, and even at the end, she would frequently speak of him in conversation, or tell stories about his headstrong ways to my children. But she was tough in spirit. She survived to enjoy her grandchildren and her new life. She left her mark on the history of our country. It will be, I am sure, a great history. Free of British domination, the nation has prospered, and I along with it. Perhaps on some other anniversary of the United States, somebody will read this and see what the cost has been. Father said, in war, the dead pay the debts of the living, and they have paid us well. But somehow, even 50 years later, I keep thinking that there might have been another way, besides war, to achieve the same end. A note from the authors. How much of this book is true? Historians have a great many ways of finding out what happened in the past and why, but they cannot find out everything. In writing this book, we have stuck to history as closely as we could, but of course we have had to make a good deal of it up. The town of Reading, Connecticut is real, and existed in those days exactly as we have described it, at least insofar as we know. The house we have called the Meeker Tavern is still there, at the southeast corner of the junction of Route 58 and Cross Highway. The church burned down and another was built on the site in 1833. In the churchyard, you can find the gravestones of various members of the Heron and Meeker families. General Putnam's Reading encampment is now known as Putnam Park. A few huts have been rebuilt to show how they were in the old days, and if you ever go there, you can see the slope where somebody might have slipped down from stump to stump, although today it is overgrown with trees again. Many of the people were real, too.
General Israel Putnam was a famous American patriot, the tough-minded, loyal, brave kind of man we have described him as. Colonel Reed was also a real person, and did the sort of things we had him do in this book. Tom Warrops was real, and really lived in a hut, such as we have described it, up behind Colonel Reed's house. Ned, the slave, was real, and he died exactly as we have described it. William Heron was a real but somewhat mysterious figure in history. It appears that he was working for the Americans as well as the British. At the least, he must have been a double agent, but historians are not sure exactly what role he played in the war. Captain Betts, Daniel Starr, Amos Rogers, Little Jerry Sanford, the minister John Beach, these two were real people, and they lived and died just as we have told it here. Of course, the exact things that we have had these people do and say in this book are fictitious. We have tried to make them act as we believe they would have acted under these circumstances, but we are only guessing. What about the Meekers? There was a Meeker family in Reading who owned the mill down by the Aspetuck River where Jerry and Tim went fishing for shad. You can find the spot near where Meeker Hill crosses the river. But we don't know much more about the Meekers than that. Essentially, we have made them up. Tim, Sam, and their mother and father. Betsy Reed, too, we made up. We have been as careful as we could to make sure that they did the kinds of things they would have done in those days. However, we have used modern language in telling the story. Partly this was to make the story easier to read, but mainly it is because nobody is really sure how people talked in those days. What about the story itself? The main historical incidents are all real, except, of course, for the part the Meeker family played in them. Yale students did rush away to get weapons and join the war in 1775. The rebels did come through Reading and collect people's weapons, because Reading really was a strong Tory town. The trip across to Verplank's Point was invented, but Verplank's Point was real. You can visit the town of Verplank today, and people did make the sort of trip that the Meekers made. Furthermore, cowboys, such as we have described, were stealing cattle and robbing people. The British raid on Reading under General Tryon really happened just as we have told it. The rebel messenger was shot, and the fighting at Daniel Starr's house, according to eyewitness reports, occurred in the way we described it, including the beheading of Ned. Moreover, Captain Betts, Mr. Rogers, Jerry Sanford, and some others were later released, but Jerry Sanford died in a prison ship sometime afterwards. Of course, there was no execution of Sam Meeker, because Sam didn't really exist. Sadly, however, the butcher, Edward Jones, and a 17-year-old soldier named John Smith were executed by Putnam very much as we have described the death of Sam Meeker. The eyewitness reports on the event are somewhat contradictory, so we cannot be sure of all details, but we have taken the execution of Sam Meeker as much as possible from the shooting of the real John Smith. The place where it happened is still known as Gallows Hill. And so that leaves one last question. Could the United States have made its way without all that agony and killing? That is probably a question that you will have to answer for yourself.
You have been enjoying an audio bookshelf production of My Brother Sam is Dead by James Lincoln Collier and Christopher Collier, and read by John C. Brown. For more information on this or any other audio bookshelf production, call 1-800-234-1713. Or write to Audio Bookshelf, Prescott Hill Road, Northport, Maine, 04849. My Brother Sam is Dead, copyright 1974 by James Lincoln Collier and Christopher Collier. Recorded by permission of the authors.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.